ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of December. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, the WHO recommends weight loss drugs to treat obesity, but high costs and supply issues mean that those who need it most continue to struggle. And a US strike on a suspected drug boat leads to allegations of a possible war crime.
The law is clear. If the facts are as have been alleged, that there was a second strike specifically to kill the survivors in the water, that's a stone cold war crime. It's also murder.
The Albanese government is adopting a lighter touch on the regulation of artificial intelligence. Under the new national AI plan, the blueprint for developing the sector and managing the worst harms of the new technology, the federal government will steer away from mandatory guardrails for the tech industry. A new AI safety institute will be established to guard against the worst excesses of AI, but will it be enough? Nick Grimm reports.
Artificial intelligence might be the world's new frontier, but that doesn't mean Australians don't worry about what it's set to bring.
I'd personally say I'm concerned about it because there's a lot of different fields that it's impacting.
It's an easy way to spread misinformation, and people can manipulate it to work in their own ways and benefit them in their own ways and stuff like that. That should be safety rails.
I'd be more worried about it than excited because it could take over people's jobs, and I'm not a fan of that. And that does scare me. I mean, okay, I think some of it could be good in some ways, but a lot of it is, to me, it's like another way of hacking in a way.
Others, though, can see the upsides.
As long as I can still, like, use it to cheat on my assignments, like, I have no problems with it.
Now, after 2 years of consultations, the federal government has released its blueprint for capturing the benefits of the AI revolution, while also implementing measures it says will mitigate against the harms it also brings, such as deepfake pornography and other abuses of the tech. Andrew Charlton is the Assistant Minister for Science, Technology and the Digital Economy.
The plan that the government is releasing today is all about people, making sure that the benefits of artificial intelligence accrue to every single Australian. If we get this right, AI has the potential to increase the prosperity and potential of the Australian people.
But the government has chosen to take a softer approach to regulation, in contrast to the so-called mandatory guardrails promised last year by former Industry Minister Ed Husic. His successor in the job sees great possibilities ahead.
It really is quite exciting.
Industry Minister Tim Ayres says guardrails of a sort will exist, but rather than being imposed on the sector, they'll be overseen by a new AI Safety Institute being set up to monitor the technology and provide government with advice on gaps in the law.
Well, I don't want to play with words too much, but the National AI Centre released a series of guardrails, not mandatory guardrails, but guardrails for business adoption that will see significant improvement in the way that businesses understand their responsibilities in terms of artificial intelligence.
It's an approach welcomed by businesses seeking to exploit the endless possibilities of AI. Sunita Bose is the Managing Director of the Digital Industry Group, Digi, which advocates for the tech sector.
The National AI Plan gives much needed clarity on how Australia will approach artificial intelligence. AI is developing globally at a rapid pace, so having a clear national direction is essential. This plan sets the foundation for how Australia will benefit from the technology while also managing its risks responsibly.
Is the Australian government doing the wrong thing by avoiding so-called mandatory guardrails for the sector?
Digi welcomes the government's focus on building a strong and safe AI ecosystem for Australians. Australia does have robust laws that apply to AI, such as the Online Safety Act. And this new plan says, let's start with those strong foundations and assess where genuine gaps exist.
But others fear the government's approach is failing to meet the challenges and threats posed by artificial intelligence. Professor Toby Walsh is Chief Scientist with UNSW's AI Institute.
Sadly, I'm a bit underwhelmed. It doesn't say anything that's wrong, but it doesn't show the ambition that I think we need.
What would you have liked to have seen?
Well, a week ago, for example, the UK announced their AI growth plan. Similar concerns. Obviously, they want to grow the economy like we do, and they're worried about AI safety. And they were announcing lots of inward investment, private companies that were investing billions of dollars. I'm not seeing that sort of ambition. And I just fear in a couple of years' time, you and I will be having another call or saying about how did Australia miss the AI race? And how do we have all these AI harms because we haven't been regulating it?
Professor Toby Walsh from UNSW's AI Institute. Nick Grimm with that report. In a landmark policy, the World Health Organization has endorsed the use of Ozempic-style medications for the long-term treatment of obesity. New WHO guidelines describe obesity as a chronic relapsing condition that affects 1 billion people globally. It recommends medications, including Ozempic, should be used alongside behavioral treatments such as diet and exercise. But experts say drugs must only be used under strict clinical guidance, with Australia's medicines regulator warning patients could experience serious mental health side effects. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Obesity is a serious chronic health issue that's linked to more than 3.5 million deaths around the world each year. And for the first time, the World Health Organization is recommending GLP-1 therapies, including weight loss medicines like Ozempic, Wegovy and Mounjaro, should be used for long-term treatment.
And that's, I think, is a really important word, long-term treatment for obesity.
Dr. Terry Lynn South is the chair of the Royal Australian College of GPs Obesity Management Group. She says GLP-1 medications are an important tool, but they're only one part of obesity treatment.
So these medications are not a quick fix, and that, you know, the relative pros and cons of the medications means that they have a role in obesity management. And it's not just about weight loss. We need to do more in regards to appropriate behavioural and lifestyle changes, not just, you know, dietary practices and physical activity, but also our behaviours around that. And we need supportive environments to enable those changes.
The new WHO guidance recommends GLP-1s be offered alongside intensive behavioural interventions and notes the recommendation is conditional due to limited data on their long-term efficacy. It also identifies the need to improve cost-effectiveness and access. There are several GLP-1 medications approved for use in Australia, but they're only subsidised on the Pharmaceutical Benefits Scheme for treatment of type 2 diabetes. Without a subsidy, the drugs can cost hundreds of dollars a month. The Royal Australian College of GPs has been calling for the drugs to be subsidised on the PBS for broader use, arguing it would reduce health inequity and lead to overall health budget savings. Dr. Terry Lynn South says the government and drug companies need to do more to reduce cost to patients.
The people who need the medication the most, based in regards to the severity of obesity and its complications, typically are the ones who can afford it least.
The WHO guidelines come a day after Australia's medicines regulator, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, issued a safety warning on the use of GLP-1 medications. The TGA says patients may be at risk of suicidal thoughts or behaviours. In a separate warning, the TGA says terzapeptide, known by the brand name Mounjaro, may reduce the effectiveness of oral contraception. Dr. Terry Lynn South says the advice highlights the importance of clinical oversight.
And if someone is being driven to use these medications in a way that has not been researched, you know, more of an aesthetic drive, that they don't actually have significant health complications, I hope that makes them have a second thought. But at the same time, for patients that really need these medications, every prescriber and patient needs to do an individual, you know, risk-benefit analysis.
University of Auckland diabetes and obesity expert Professor Peter Shepherd says while GLP-1s are safe and effective for most people, clinicians and patients should be wary of possible mental health and physical side effects.
For example, if you don't eat enough, you can miss out on vitamins and minerals, so you need to make sure that that's kept an eye on. And also, there's a number of people taking these medicines can go a bit too far and then they lose muscle mass, and that loss of muscle mass is also not a good thing. So you really need to be doing this in conjunction with your clinician.
Professor Peter Shepherd from the University of Auckland, ending that report by Bridget Fitzgerald. The Trump administration is being accused of committing a war crime by ordering a second lethal strike on a suspected drug trafficking boat in the Caribbean in September. Two survivors were left clinging to the wreck of the boat after the first strike, but were killed in the second. While the White House has defended the second strike on the vessel, the president says that he personally would not have wanted it, and he even cast doubt on the idea that the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, had even ordered the strike. Here's Rachel Mealy.
The Trump administration has made much of its war on drug cartels. In September and October, the US military carried out drone attacks on alleged drug trafficking boats in the Caribbean Sea and the Pacific Ocean. But now those strikes are the subject of questions from both sides of politics. Republican Congressman Mike Turner says the September 2nd strike appears to be illegal.
This is completely outside of anything that has been discussed with Congress. Obviously, if that occurred, that would be very serious, and I agree that would be an illegal act.
The Washington Post has reported that Pete Hegseth gave a verbal order to kill everyone on board the boats, and on September 2nd, that meant the military commander in charge of the operation ordered a second strike to kill two people who'd survived the initial hit. Independent Senator Angus King says the incident needs to be investigated.
The law is clear. If the facts are as have been alleged, that there was a second strike specifically to kill the survivors in the war, in the water, that's a stone-cold war crime. It's also murder.
The White House is standing by the admiral who ordered the hit. White House spokesperson Caroline Levitt says he was authorized to destroy the boat.
President Trump and Secretary Hegseth have made it clear that presidentially designated narco-terrorist groups are subject to lethal targeting in accordance with the laws of war. With respect to the strikes in question on September 2nd, Secretary Hegseth authorized Admiral Bradley to conduct these kinetic strikes. Admiral Bradley worked well within his authority and the law, directing the engagement to ensure the boat was destroyed and the threat to the United States of America was eliminated.
But later, aboard Air Force One, the president seemed to walk back that statement and suggested that Pete Hegseth didn't authorize a second strike.
The first strike was very legal, it was fine, and if there were two people around, but Pete said that didn't happen.
Does that make you?
I have great confidence.
Yeah. No second strike?
I don't know, I'm going to find out about it, but Pete said he did not order the death of those two men.
Former U.S. Air Force Colonel Cedric Layton is a leading U.S. military analyst.
Well, clearly there's an issue here. The mission itself against Venezuela is questionable from a legal standpoint. The other aspect very specifically to the strike in question, which happened on the 2nd of September, that also directly begs several questions. One of them is, what did the military know, the U.S. military, And when exactly did they know it? When did they realize that there were survivors? Did they know that before this second strike, or did they know it only in the aftermath?
Former U.S. Air Force Colonel Cedric Layton ending Rachel Mealy's report. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. What's the cheapest and most efficient option, to refurbish 44 public housing towers in Melbourne, or just demolish them and relocate the residents and rebuild them in 30 years' time? That's a key question for a Victorian government inquiry, which is being handed down this lunchtime. Some independent architects believe the 60-year-old towers are structurally sound and are frustrated by the lack of public access to documents relating to the buildings. Here's Kimberly Price.
Kadisha Alahashi has been living in her Flemington public housing apartment for 25 years. It's where she raised her children.
I'm not happy to move, but we have no choice. That's the problem. We have anxiety. We have everything. There's nothing we can do. Our life has become limbo.
Kadisha Alahashi's home is in a building which the Victorian government plans to demolish and move all those residents into developed dwellings across Melbourne. The grandmother will soon have to move to a unit in Essendon North, which is around a 15-minute drive away from her current apartment.
If I move, I have to pay electricity. I have to pay water.
While the state government provides a relocation officer to every household, Kadisha Alahashi feels like she hasn't been adequately consulted about the move.
We need support. We need people to help us to understand our situation, to save for public housing. Please.
Every morning, activists line the busy racecourse road out the front of Khadija Al-Hashi's complex, encouraging motorists to toot in support of saving the towers from demolition. They're part of the state government's plan to demolish all 44 public housing towers in Melbourne and rebuild them by 2051. Peter Silby devoted his career to social housing and is part of the picket line.
We need a just and fair society where low-income people's housing needs are served by public housing as well as good quality community housing.
Instead of rebuilding, Peter Silby wants to see the existing towers renovated, eliminating the need for residents to move out.
We could increase the sustainability and quality of housing, add balconies, do a lot of refurbishment work.
Nigel Bertram is a practice professor of architecture at Monash University and the director of NMBW Architecture Studio. He's been looking into the state government's decision.
On an apples-for-apples comparison, it's a sort of unanimous understanding that a retrofit and refurbish and bringing these buildings, keeping the existing structure, but bringing them up to contemporary standards would be cheaper by about 25% at a very conservative estimate.
He says renovating the existing buildings would also be better for the environment and support the government's target to build 800,000 new homes over the next 10 years. The government says the existing towers fail numerous building standards, including noise, sustainability, energy efficiency, and ventilation. But Nigel Bertram says it's difficult to understand the true nature of the structures.
The government has not released any of the reports they say they've referred to or any of the advice, despite repeated requests. And it's this secrecy that makes the whole process very frustrating.
The Minister for Housing and Building, Harriet Shing, says the towers redevelopment will triple housing capacity across the sites and the rights and rent settings of all relocating residents will remain the same.
Kimberly Price there. No favourites, that's the title of the long-awaited Briggs report into public sector board appointments, and yet the review finds there are very much favourites in the halls of power. The report, dubbed an investigation into jobs for mates, was sat on since 2023 by the Albanese government. It found that too often governments handed jobs to friends or hand-picked candidates for political purposes, thus eroding trust within the public. Geoffrey Watson SC is a barrister specialising in anti-corruption and is on the board of the Centre for Public Integrity. He joined me earlier. Geoffrey Watson, this report is a bit of a peek behind the curtains of power in Australia, into the backrooms and deals and favours of the well-connected, and it focused on the, quote, 200 or so governing and decision-making boards that make important decisions affecting all Australians. What do you think it revealed?
Well, it reveals that the current system is in terrible condition insofar as there continues to be exactly what the public thinks, that is, the appointment of friends, political friends, family and friends, failed politicians to important boards and decision-making roles. Also, it's influencing the ultimate conduct of the various bodies because you know somebody's politics, their choices, so you're influencing the direction of the decision-making.
There's a lot of shades of grey to this in the way that people are appointed to public boards. This report found that even though only 6-7% of all board appointments can be automatically described as political, as many as 50% of appointments in some portfolios are what's called direct appointments made by ministers. Is this a surprise to you? Is it a concern to you?
I've known this has been going on. I've been watching and complaining about it now, as your listeners would know, for about a decade. So it's not a surprise. It's a continuing disappointment. Can I put it that way, Andy?
What does the delay in the Albanese government's release of this report mean, in your opinion?
It means a couple of things. First of all, it's a real scar, I think, on the credibility of the Albanese government in introducing accountability, transparency, etc. The 18-month delay, you can't explain it innocently. The second thing is that it's meant that a lot of appointments have been made in the intervening period, which are questionable appointments. Now, there's going to be some of those which have been made since they've had the report. I'm going at the Centre for Public Integrity to recommend we undertake an audit to have a look at the appointments made while the Labor Party has known that this new regime should be put in place.
The government hasn't committed to all or, in fact, any of the specific recommendations made in this review. Instead, it announced a new sort of list of principles to inform decision-making, a new framework that will come into effect in February next year. What did you make of some of these recommendations? Are they moderate or did they go far enough?
The periods that they're talking about, the delay between serving as a politician or as a minister and the appointment to the board, they're all very sensible delay periods. Also, getting rid of these tombstone appointments, that is, somebody's on the way out in their career and they're given an opportunity on these kinds of boards. This has got to stop. Now, the review brought forward sound, sensible recommendations. Why is Labor not picking them up? Why did they have an independent review if at all times they intended to impose their own political judgment, contrary to anything which came from the independent experts?
I think a lot of people would have understood that the status quo in Canberra has been such for many years. And is the Labor government unfairly wearing this review's results when, in fact, it's the revolving door of both coalition and Labor governments that this culture has been, you know, a factor in?
Oh, you're so right. The thing is, we can blame Labor today, but over the last 10 years, I've been blaming both sides whenever they get power. They talk tough when they're in opposition. We're going to bring in an accountable system, merit-based system, and then they get into power, and all of a sudden you find their friends and their political allies, maybe sometimes their donors, are finding themselves appointed to boards with all sorts of advantage attached to them.
Geoffrey Watson, SC, always a pleasure. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
A deaf man who uses sign language interpreters to communicate will have his funding halved, with the National Disability Insurance Scheme recommending he explore other communication methods. It's a case which highlights the tension between the ballooning cost of the NDIS and its service delivery with the needs and preferences of the scheme's recipients. Advocates have accused NDIS staff of not understanding deafness. More from National Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella.
What's happening with you? What's brought you in today?
Having an Australian Sign Language or Auslan interpreter at his GP appointments is essential for Melbourne man Heath Wharton.
Might be a little bit cold on your back here. Take some breaths in and out.
The 40-year-old was born profoundly deaf and is communicating here via an interpreter.
I can't hear anything. My first language is Auslan. This is the language I have used my whole life.
Mr. Wharton uses his NDIS funding to pay for interpreters so he can access appointments and social events. His recent plan contained around 200 hours a year, but when he asked for more, his funding was reduced to 100 hours a year. His new plan also increased funding for services like speech therapy and audiology. In documents seen by the ABC, the agency that runs the NDIS, the NDIA, recommended Mr. Wharton explore other communication methods. The agency said this could increase the number of people he could interact with, which would be significantly more cost-effective than funding ever-increasing hours of Auslan interpreting.
It's like the NDIS think that magically I will become a hearing person. That is unacceptable. I am a deaf person. That's it. You cannot fix the fact that I am deaf.
Catherine Dunn, who is deaf and from advocacy organisation DeafConnect, says this is not an isolated case. She's also speaking through an interpreter.
It is a systemic problem. The NDIA was set up to encourage participants to choose how they want to live their life independently and have those communication options that best cater for them.
Ms. Dunn says funding decisions are dependent on the expertise of the staff at the agency assessing individual plans.
For deaf people, it feels like it's almost like a flip of a coin as far as which person they're going to have meeting them from the NDIA. You have some fantastic planners and then you have those that aren't as informed.
In a statement, the NDIA has told the ABC that Mr. Wharton continues to receive NDIS supports, including funding for interpreting services. It adds that agency employees come from a diverse range of backgrounds and that 22% of its staff identify as living with disability. Meanwhile, Mr. Wharton is taking his case for more funding to the Administrative Review Tribunal. And his message for the agency is simple.
I'm a deaf person. I'm proud of that.
Melbourne man Heath Wharton communicating via an interpreter, ending that report by Naz Campanella. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hello, I'm Sydney Peed from the ABC News Daily podcast. In a flurry of peace talks, Ukrainian officials have been desperately trying to avoid an unfair end to Russia's war. Today, an international relations expert, Rajan Menon, on whether this latest round of diplomacy offers any real hope and what Kyiv may still have to give up. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.